This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, with a 15% drawdown in the S&P 500 this year and a 25% decline in the NASDAQ, that's not even from highs, that's just this year, a lot of you out there may be wondering when and where is the bottom of this equity market. Well, Cameron Kreiz went back nearly 70 years, all the way back to 1954, to take a look at the history of major market bottoms to give us an idea of what we should be looking for. Cameron Kreiz is macro strategist for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from Connecticut. So, Cameron, what are the factors that you looked at when trying to understand how to recognize a bottom in this market?
Well, I was really just focused on monetary policy because ultimately that's kind of the dominant theme at the moment, right? The Fed hiking rates in response to inflation, which is then providing a significant headwind for the market. So I thought it'd be interesting just to go back and look at previous bottoms to see what essentially what the Fed was up to and to see if we can find any parallels to the current situation of an aggressive Fed and whether the market can bottom when the Fed is being so aggressive. So I defined a major bottom as kind of the lowest price point versus the all the closing prices of the previous year and for the ensuing year. It's something that you can look at and see very clearly on a chart and point your finger at it. But you know, you kind of have to define it mathematically when you're working with numbers. So it's the sort of thing that you can only really tell in retrospect.
Too bad.
So essentially what I looked at is the level at these dates that did signal these previous bottoms, and there are 18 previous ones between 1957 and the COVID low of March 2020. I looked at what's the Fed funds rate versus the one-year peak, i.e. the highest Fed funds rate of the previous year. What's been the three-month change in the Fed funds rate, and what's been the three-month change in the 10-year yield? And I guess unsurprisingly, most of these bottoms have formed when interest rates are coming lower. On 14 of the prior occasions, either the Fed has already been cutting or bond yields have been moving lower. So, for example, on Christmas Eve of 2018, the Fed, I guess they had technically quit cutting, but we didn't know it at the time. But certainly, they had quit raising rates, although we didn't know it at the time, hadn't been confirmed, and certainly on a three-month basis, the Fed funds rate had moved higher, but the 10-year yield had started to come lower, indicating that investors were sort of clamoring for easier financial conditions. So there have been four occasions when interest rates have not fallen in any shape at the time of a market bottom. For many listeners, they'll be sort of ancient history. Even for me, they're sort of ancient history. So in 1957, in 1962, both of which I think are not particularly good analogs because the 10-year yield really didn't move that much over the prior 3 months, whereas obviously more recently it's gone up a lot. 1978, the Fed had put Interest rates up, the Fed funds rate up by 25 basis points in response to inflation, and the 10-year yield had moved up by about 42 basis points. And then in 1984, the Fed had hiked 50, and the 10-year yield had moved up by 59 basis points. So you could argue maybe that the 1978 and 1984 examples are sort of analogous to what we're having now, but I would argue that the Fed is nevertheless being much more aggressive this time. So when we come to June, they're going to put rates up another 50 basis points. That'll be essentially almost 125 basis points in 3 months, which is off the charts compared to everything they've done previously. And then obviously the 10-year yield has moved a lot more to the upside than it has at the time of any of these previous lows. So you'd have to say that right now the Fed is a little too aggressive to be consistent with a stock market low, at least based on the last, 70 years of history since the middle of the Eisenhower administration.
Fascinating stuff, really. Tim, did you know a fun fact here?
I probably didn't. Okay, what is it?
That Cameron Kreis used to be my teacher back in the
day. I did not know that.
He did. He was a tough one, but he was smart because he did this exact thing. He would say, look at the historical precedents, and you can see why, because he just kind of gave us his argument. Cam, Crady here, by the way.
I used my context clues to do so.
There you go. Detective work there. I love this line that you say in your piece: market weakness doesn't look sufficiently broad-based to represent real capitulation. But is capitulation necessary to form a bottom in this market?
I think it kind of is. You need the babies to get chucked out with the bathwater. Because that sets up a situation where once the market does start going up, people immediately feel underinvested. And I don't think we're quite there yet. Certainly, if you look at past lows, they tend to coincide with a very, very high proportion of the stocks in the S&P 500 trading below their 200-day moving average. And while roughly maybe 70% of the S&P stocks are trading below their 200-day moving average, normally you see that sort of 85% or more that are trading below that 200-day, which, again, would be consistent with a broader-based capitulation. So I'm a little skeptical that we're bottoming at the moment, because it just doesn't feel like we've had that panic. The VIX hasn't traded above 40. I think if you make a new high in VIX and you see the vast proportion of stocks in the S&P trading below their 200-day, then you can say, well, this is legitimate panic. And that's the stuff of which bottoms are made. But that just doesn't feel like we're there yet.
That's what we need to look for. Cameron Kreis, macro strategist at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from Connecticut this afternoon.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
When President Joe Biden made the case for nearly $200 billion pandemic aid package to help states dodge budget cuts and layoffs, quarter horse racing never came up. Yet Arizona is now using a portion of the aid to boost purses at three of its horse tracks. Alaska is paying social media influencers to promote the state's famous seafood. And then what's happening in North Carolina is interesting, funding improvements to a speedway for NASCAR races and building new walking trails dedicated to the history of moonshine. So write Amanda Albright and Danielle Moran in among their latest pieces. Amanda Albright joins us now. She's Bloomberg News municipal finance reporter. She's with us from the newsroom here in New York City. Amanda, good to have you with us. We've talked a lot in the past year about how flush with cash states have been, and we saw no greater example than on Friday when we heard from California and their budget surplus. But why are states spending this money on such niche products? I mean, projects, aren't there big problems to solve?
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And so I would definitely say that we're seeing these kind of small items pop up in state spending of federal aid from the Biden administration. But to be fair to the states, we're also seeing them spend a lot of the aid on infrastructure projects, think water, sewer. We're seeing them use some of the money to help K-12 education. But I think these kind of smaller projects, like helping the NASCAR track in Charlotte, North Carolina, I think that kind of reflects just how much money states have to go around. And there is a debate over exactly your question, which is just, are there better ways to use this? Are there smarter ways to use this? Is this compounding economic problems? So it's a very interesting debate that hits at a lot of kind of big economic questions right now.
Amanda, I love this line in your story. If you'll indulge me, I'm going to read it out to our audience. The bonanza is a window into just how extreme the federal largesse was, and to some extent is only pouring fuel on an inflation spiral the Fed is now trying to quell. Can you connect the dots for us on how this relates to the inflation spiral?
I guess so. The concern is that the U.S. poured so much money into states that when they're actually in a position to do things like provide larger awards to horse jockeys and horse breeders in Arizona, that's just adding to, the money that's gone into the economy and just how there's so much consumer spending. At the same time, we are also seeing states float a lot of tax cuts, whether through tax rebates and longer-term tax cuts. So that also adds to the questions about whether states could be making inflation worse.
Amanda, what was sort of the most surprising use of funds that you saw? I was pretty tickled by the influencers pushing for Alaskan seafood. But I got to tell you, it kind of makes sense if it's an ad campaign for a really important export. What really surprised you?
Absolutely. I think exactly that surprised me, that in each case of – so we included North Carolina, we included Alaska, we included Arizona. I think in each case, the officials that we – talked to, they were able to give a response. They said, this is why this industry needs the money. And so I think the kind of core tension of the story is just that, industries can be helped with this aid and it's an allowable use, but there is going to be scrutiny over how states did that, because of course people will be questioning whether cooking influencers should have gotten the aid. But in the mind of the folks in Alaska, that's a perfectly reasonable use of the money. And so I think that kind of debate is super, super interesting. And of course, like us tracking and reporting on the money, we want to, be transparent with where the money is going in our coverage and kind of make sure people know that federal aid is, finding its way to influencers at the end of the day.
Amanda, about 30 seconds here. I'm curious about this scrutiny that you were just talking about. Will there be more scrutiny for some of these investment uses?
Absolutely. I think we're already seeing a lot of key Republicans talk about how the aid is being used, and I would definitely expect that folks like Mitch McConnell and other Republican leaders will definitely be playing this up in some of their advertising and press releases. So this is definitely a big talking point for them.
And just 20 seconds left, political implications of this as we head into 2022. I know you cover munis, but.
No, I think that there's definitely midterms implications. Obviously, Biden is getting a lot of negative press for inflation. And I think, stimulus spending by the states is certainly not helping his case potentially.
Great stuff. Amanda Albright is municipal finance reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from here in our New York bureau. Check out her story online and on the Bloomberg terminal. Biden's rescue money doled out to racehorse owners and influencers. Like I said, each one of these has examples for economic development. It's just, I think, hard for people to say, wait a second, shouldn't this be going to kids who were held back in school by these pandemic era lockdowns?
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Back in 1965, employment in manufacturing here in the U.S. Was 9 times that of bars and restaurants. Fast forward to 2017, food services, as they are called by the U.S. government, they were on the verge of overtaking manufacturers when it came to employees. It was all set to happen, but then COVID and the pandemic. Justin Fox writes all about it. He's a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Justin's story featured in the upcoming issue of Business Week magazine. You can read it now on the Bloomberg terminal and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. We're also joined by Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So Joel, the pandemic accelerated a lot of things, but you couple that with a tight labor market, and Justin argues that restaurants are starting to look more and more like factories, thanks to automation.
I think the headline for this story could have been "and then COVID," which would have been
right.
Example number 30,512 of that headline. And maybe we should just, you know, cut to the chase and like write a book to this effect, Justin. But I thought it was a interesting way of quantifying something that we wouldn't usually think to do this way, of like comparing restaurants and factories like this. And Justin, it sort of makes sense now. Like, I mean, I go to a restaurant and it's like I can scan a QR code and basically order for myself.
Right.
How did this story find you, do you think?
Basically, back in 2017, I was playing around with the data and sort of, I could see how much restaurant employment, food services and drinking places employment had been going up. And I thought, I wonder if I compare that to manufacturing, and saw that it was about to pass it. And that Derek Thompson at The Atlantic ended up writing about it too. And it got a bunch of attention for a while. And it actually sort of faded the next year because there was a tiny little manufacturing mini resurgence. But in February 2020, it was closer than ever. Mm. And it was really clearly restaurants were on the path to surpass them. And, you know, we know what happened next. Obviously, restaurants had to shut down in a way that factories, except for in the first few weeks, did not. But since then, it's really interesting. They're just not gaining employment like other parts of the economy.
Well, I think there are a couple of factors at play, as you write about, Justin. It's not just that the labor market is tighter, so it's getting more and more expensive to hire these workers, but also there's the inflationary pressure of these costs for restaurants going up. But then there's this perhaps resurgence in manufacturing here in the United States. We talked to a lot of CEOs about the idea of onshoring or reshoring, bringing manufacturing back to the United States. Is that something, like, are we sort of past the point where restaurants could still overtake? Could overtake manufacturing? What happens from here on out?
I mean, normally what happens in a recession is that manufacturing is more sensitive and lays off people quickly, and restaurants are slower. So you'd sort of think in a normal recession, restaurants
would... Are you saying we're in a recession?
No, but I mean, people are talking about
it. Because a lot of people are talking
about
it.
If that were to happen.
Okay.
But yeah, the COVID recession was obviously totally different. I mean, when you look at it, manufacturing is having the best recovery it's had since the 60s. But it's still not growing that fast in employment. And if restaurant employment were still growing like it were back in the previous decade, it would clearly pass it. But it's sort of this interesting moment where there have been a lot of innovations. It's not just automation, but it's like these ghost kitchens where you can order 18 different kinds of food from a single kitchen. And, you know, some of the employment has probably shifted over to delivery services away from, it doesn't get counted under restaurants, but it's still people bringing you your food. So, I mean, my answer is I don't know, but it's clearly being put off for quite a while here.
Well, I'm so glad we're talking about restaurants and inflation here, because if we actually looked at the last inflation report, one of the biggest drivers, one of the biggest movers was food away from home. But I'm wondering, if you're paying more at these restaurants or delivery apps or whatever it is, do the workers see any of that?
Yeah, I mean, wages in the restaurant industry have gone up a lot. Who knows? It's a little harder to tell what's going on with tips. But yeah, the workers are definitely seeing it. But I also think it's a tough business. And I think the pandemic made clear to a lot of people that, you know, that it wasn't a really secure line of work. And so a lot of older workers don't want to get back into it. A lot of other people, because there are other opportunities in the economy, are looking at other things. So it's just caused this kind of rebalancing, which maybe when we get past the craziness of the moment will actually be a good thing.
I have a theory. Not rooted in anything other than, you know, my own anecdotal neighborhood evidence, but
which is all that matters.
Totally. But here, you can come in and tell me what you think about it. Drinks to go. Could that change this? Huh. Because, you know, fundamentally, it means that there's a skill that you can't easily automate, which is, you know, bartending and good bartending. And maybe that has a way of changing what these numbers could look like.
Your neighborhood's a lot more fun than mine.
Well, it used to be fun, and then they cut off the to-go drinks. So it could come back at any moment. But
yeah, I mean, I would think overall to-go drinks probably – because if you're not in a bar sitting there saying, hit me again, I would think you would drink less and spend less money overall. So I mean, to-go drinks was a really important thing during the pandemic to keep a lot of these places going. But I don't think it's a recipe for lots more employment.
Just
or
got
revenue.
Shut down right there. That's what
you're not that. Getting your margarita to go.
Well, I might be able to, but it's not going to change these numbers. But okay, so what about other ways that automation is playing in here? I saw something like the QR code. How do economists view stuff like that? Because that's you would classify that in a larger sense as like a technological shift, right?
Yeah, and at this point, a lot of it's very anecdotal. My favorite one so far has actually been this Canadian restaurant chain that made these headlines because they had people in a call center in Nicaragua taking orders. So you'd go up to the drive-thru window and you'd be talking to somebody in Nicaragua. And I don't know if that got so much bad publicity that I don't know if they kept that up. But obviously, you know, there are certain things in a kitchen that can be more mechanized, and it just hasn't been worth restaurants' while to invest in that before. Now, because labor is more expensive, it might be.
Not wild about it in terms of the experience of going out, I got to be honest.
So you're in the
I like people.
You like to interact with people rather than the QR code on the menu?
Yeah, I do. And I first noticed this at airports, especially Newark Airport here in the tri-state area a few years ago before the pandemic. You know, you were ordering from these iPads. And
right.
I did notice a lot of complaints that people had about it because, you know, you don't necessarily – like, you know, you're getting it quickly, but it's not necessarily the same experience that someone has in a restaurant.
I think what's interesting, and you brought up the CPI stuff, one of the things that comes back here is this idea that, you know, you're already paying more. Right? Your food costs more.
Yeah.
Now you're not interacting with a person on top of it. And I think that leaves kind of a weird taste in a consumer's mouth of like, happened
I'm
to my restaurant
experience?
I'm
introverted, so I'm okay with that.
But don't you love, I mean, I like going somewhere and asking, you know, whoever's working there, like, what's delicious? What do people order? What do people like? And, you know, I'm a talker.
Yeah, there's like Yelp reviews for you before you put
We're
your
so different
QR code order in.
I guess it's good,
I'm with you. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, to be continued, everyone. Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week, with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. Fun conversation with Justin Fox, columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Check out Justin's story featured in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week. You can read it online now and, of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. This is Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
Keep driving crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we are under 10 minutes away from the close on this Monday, May 16th, 2022. You heard the numbers from Charlie, but worth repeating, the NASDAQ down 1.1%, the S&P 500 lower by 0.3%, the Dow Jones Industrial Average now higher by about 0.2%. John LaForge is head of Real Asset Strategy at Wells Fargo Investment Institute. He joins us on the phone from Sarasota, Florida. John, how are you?
Good, Tim. How you doing?
We're doing pretty well. I want to get into commodities with you. It's something that my co-anchor, Kriti Gupta, covers very closely here at Bloomberg. And I'm wondering about specifically the rise in commodity prices that we've been seeing. Is this something that is long-term? Because I talked to Kriti earlier, and she said trying to understand price moves in the context of geopolitics is like trying to predict when Russia's invasion of Ukraine will end.
Yeah, she's right. Now, the one thing that is a little easier to predict are the longer term cycles. So I think what you're trying to get at is right now with commodities, they all seem to be rising. That's not by coincidence. And what I mean by now is the last 2 years. What commodities do typically is they tend to go through these roughly 10-year periods where they are oversupplied And we just went through that from 2010 to 2020. But gradually, as price went down over that period, we were not adding to supply growth across the complex. What COVID did was kind of let the tide go out, and we all got to see, in a sense, and now we're paying for it, we were not really producing underneath a lot. And we need more. You know, the economies are constantly growing, the global economy. So that's really what we're faced with. And these things that have happened for the last couple years, the latest with Russia, really, frankly, just kind of goose it a little bit and really show that we don't have the supply underneath what's happening. So, yeah, I'd say this is going to go on for a while. It's a long-winded way to say we probably have a few more years left of this.
I'm curious if that gets cut short if, as you point out, the global economy is growing, but a lot of that growth, I would say arguably the majority of that growth in theory when it comes to commodity demand is coming from China. When it comes to incremental commodity demand, just overnight we had some not so great economic data, I believe industrial weakness that we haven't seen since the 1990s. How do you square a not just slowing China, but a like screeching to a stop China with this commodity super cycle?
Yeah, very good question. Because China is the biggest buyer, no question, across the board. If you look at the metals as an example, they are classically more than 45% of total demand in the world, whether we're talking copper, lead, zinc, nickel, you name it. But what often happens in commodity markets is it's not always the biggest buyer that impacts price. It's typically the marginal buyer and the marginal supplier. And China really has that 45% or so has not been moving up in the last couple of years, yet we've all noticed commodity prices are going up. And that's because the West, on the margin, is demanding more. A lot of the whole move in copper, as an example, nickel, and so on, that's the West's move to say, hey, from an ESG climate change perspective, let's spend some money over here. That's where that demand is coming from, not necessarily China. So it's that marginal side. And then from the supply side that's marginal, it's the U.S. when it comes to things like energy. We were the ones that were setting prices because we were the big producers for the last 7-8 years, and then COVID hit, and all of a sudden, we were not the big producer anymore. We were essentially not setting it, but we are the ones that typically will, and we're not producing enough. That's why prices keep going up. So I'd say, Creedy, just generally what we're looking at is you can't ignore China. They're big, the biggest, but often shorter term, you often see it's the marginal suppliers and marginal demanders. They're the ones that are setting the price.
Is it fair to call some of these commodities an inflation hedge? And I ask that with this idea or with this context for our audience that for several months, it did almost serve as an inflation hedge. As the entire market was selling off, energy stocks were the only ones in the green. And oil, for example, was the only asset in the green as well. And now it kind of seems like you've had open interest, for example, collapse, perhaps, and tell me if I'm wrong here, because investors don't want that exposure to the volatility. And in that kind of environment, is it fair to still call commodities, food or metals or energy, an inflation hedge?
Yeah, so I kind of tackle it from two angles. One is from the commodity perspective. Yes, it typically is a decent inflation hedge, and we've just witnessed that. So most of when you look at the portfolios today, bonds are down, stocks are down, commodities are up. So, yes, it really can be from that angle. Now, the stock side, this is where it gets kind of interesting, is what we often find is commodities, when they enter these big 10-year bull markets where they're going up in price, usually stocks aren't doing that well, and not poorly. They're not going down, but they're not getting their best gains during that time. And how that floats into the commodity producers, and this is something investors have probably recognized recently, is many of their commodity-producing stocks are still going down over the last month, even though commodity prices are going up. And that's because roughly, if you look at a commodity-producing stock, about 50% of the performance of that stock will move with the stock market, and the other half will move classically with the underlying commodity. And so you have to be careful.
Right.
If you're looking for an inflation hedge, you probably should be looking for the commodity,
right,
not necessarily the producer.
John LaForge, head of real asset strategy at Wells Fargo Investment Institute, joining us live on the phone from Sarasota, Florida. John, thanks so much for joining us on Bloomberg Business Week. Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.